Shalom, shalom uvracha, everybody. Ooh, I am thrilled to be here with Leslie Jordan. He has been on Will and Grace. He has been on Murphy Brown, American Horror Story, the HBO special Pink Carpet, also the show's Sordid Lives, and the one-man show Southern Baptist Sissies and Hysterical Blindness. And now you can all go see him at the Metropolitan Room this week in Manhattan doing his new solo show, Exposed. Ooh. So, first of all, shalom, Mr. Jordan. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I love to hear shalom because there was, in our tiny little town, one Jewish community center that a very vibrant Jewish community. But my sister, we were raised in the Baptist faith, got a job, and this is the way in which she would answer the phone with her deep Southern accent. Shalom, Jewish community center, may I help you?
Even hearing that would make Jews convert. Oh, my God. So let me ask you, Leslie Jordan, growing up, what does it mean? I can never tell the difference between all these Christians. You got the Christians and the Lutherans and the what does it mean specifically to be a Baptist?
Well, I was always a Baptist, but I wanted to be a Methodist because Methodists are Baptists who like to drink, but they're not rich enough to be Episcopalians. So, in the Baptist faith, if you misbehave, you have to get baptized. And then once you're dunked, then you're saved from eternal hellfire. But you only have to do that one time. But I've been baptized 14 times because I just wasn't sure it took.
Good Lord. You must be waterlogged at this point. Oh, my God. So, you must have
lots of material from it over the years, that's for sure.
Well, I know the producer and the host of this program saw many years ago your one-man show, Hysterical Blindness, which was telling your story. Can I ask, what is different about that show, which was autobiographical then, and your brand-new solo show, Exposed? Exposed!
Well, here's the main difference. I got so much notoriety from Hysterical Blindness years ago. I started writing these other one-person shows because I realized that I had an ability to stand on stage and talk about my life, both the good and the bad, and make a little money at it, which was the deciding factor.
Oh, because everybody makes good money from one-man shows in off-Broadway theater.
But see, what I do is I take it out on the road, and I can make good money because you go to Atlanta, Georgia, or you go here, you go there. I do 44 venues a year. I'm sitting right now in Provincetown, Massachusetts, out on the Cape, and I've got two nights here, and then I come to New York, and I do the Metropolitan Room, and then, of course, you know I'm opening in Neon Boots, a gay bar in Houston, Texas.
But
the difference, I would say, is that I just currently talk about what's going on in my life right now, and that is, you know, that...
But now you're rich and famous. What is there to talk about?
Well, there's lots to talk about because I can now talk about rich and famous people that I meet that are mean to me.
Come on. Oh, now you got to do it. Now you got to do the Kathy Griffin thing. So tell us. I mean, not holding up the president's head, but the other part.
I was being facetious because nobody has ever really been mean to me. I'm dead serious. Only one person years ago, Don Johnson, made me cry, but he apologized. He was very mean to me. But
What did he say? What did he do?
Don Johnson, I was doing a television series in San Francisco. They flew me up. It was called Nash Bridges. And he was just in a bad mood. He wanted to get out of there early. And he came in and he said, instead of rehearsing, let's just shoot this. Because it's just he and I standing, pointing to me. He said, it's just he and I standing in front of a coffin. And we can, you know, look down at the dead body. He can just say his lines and let's get out of here. Well, I hadn't memorized it. I don't work like that. You know what I mean? If I use blocking, in other words, if I know I'm in front of the coffin, I have to go here. You know, I'm a very quick study, but I didn't have it down yet. And so he said, let's shoot it right now. So I ran over to the people that provide all the props, and I said, "Give me a clipboard. I'm a funeral director, and I'll just put my lines on this clipboard, and I'll do the Marlon Brando thing. I'll just look down and read it if I have to." Well, I did very well first take, and Don said, "We're going to go again in front of everybody." He said, "Because our actor that we flew up from Los Angeles was reading his lines off a clipboard." I said, "Mr. Johnson, why don't you look at the playback? Because I very seldom, I mean, I glance down. I'm a funeral director. Of course I glance down when I have to see who I'm burying." And anyway, he just went ballistic on me. So I went to the side of the set there, and I thought, "I'm going to cry. I've never had somebody just call me up." Well, somebody came over and took my hand, started holding my hand and bumping me with their butt, and I thought maybe it was one of the sweet makeup girls or something, you know, to comfort me. I looked up, and it was him. He's holding my hand. We're standing there holding hands like little girls. He said to me, "Are you pouting?" I said, "No, I'm not pouting, but I've never been, you know, dressed down like that." Within 20 minutes, he had charmed me to the point where I was just putty in his hands. "Oh, Mr. Johnson, you're so funny. I just love him." But I watched him do it repeatedly. You know what I mean? Dress down people and lose his temper. I'm sure he's much better now.
Maybe he was on certain pharmaceuticals at that point, if you think about it.
Yeah. He's sober now, I think. Seriously, he's probably sober now. You know,
I'm sure now. Now, speaking of sober, you were very open about being an addictive personality. How did you go from being a nice little Southern gay person coming to, I guess it was a big city, and then going into the party world and getting hooked on things?
Well, you know what happened was, when I was about 14 years old, I drank for the very first time. My family were Baptist. They're Baptists or teetotalers.
Right.
And I'd always been very self-conscious about being somewhat effete, you know, very effeminate. And I'm a self-conscious kid and so scared of my secret, because you have no idea how deep and dark the gay thing is in the pew of a Baptist church in the Deep South in the 1960s, you know, late 50s, 1960s. And so when I had my first drink, all of a sudden, I was just precious. You know, I was adorable. I had no problem with being effeminate. And the amazing thing is, I went on a 33-year journey into any, you know, drugs and alcohol and part of this, and then the 80s, you know, the 60s, and then the LSD and the acid, and then the 70s came along, and it was Quaaludes and Studio 54, and then in the 80s, there was a lot of cocaine and burying people. You know, we had the AIDS crises, and that's what we did. You know, we just marked names out of our telephone directories and went to memorial services, and the band played on, you know. And then the 90s, and then in 1997 is when I got completely clean and sober, and that was after my unfortunate incarceration.
Well, that's right. You had a DUI, right? Or you were driving?
Five in a row.
Oh, God.
Five. Well, three for driving drunk, and then two where I was framed.
You were in the passenger and somebody blamed it on you?
Yeah, well, no, I'm being silly. It was for several little indiscretions I'd really rather not discuss.
Oh, good Lord. Okay.
But anyway, I did some jail time. That was the best thing that ever happened to me. My cellmate really was Robert Downey Jr., 152 Pod A, cell 13.
Now, this is amazing, because anybody, you know, considering that you are a relatively effeminate little guy, to go to prison, you are very lucky to be there with a famous actor rather than some, like, 8-foot black man named Bubba who is going to use you, you know, like a washing machine.
But you know what? I was very popular for the wrong reason. I mean, people, when I say I was very popular, they go, "I guess you were." But not for that. I'm a big talker, and the worst part about being incarcerated is the boredom. And so people who can tell stories and entertain are just gold. I mean, I was just the belle of the ball. You know, they just all loved me because I could tell funny stories. Come over here and tell me a story. So I would tell stories, which, you know, is what I do now and get paid for on stage.
Well, how long were you?
I'll tell you something.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to tell you something that happened to me this week that I'm pretty sure I can announce now.
Oh, please.
When I was I just got a really big job. I'm so excited about it.
Was it big? Yeah.
When I was a kid, my family was so devout. You know, I knew that my only window out on the world, because all we did was go to church, spent a lot of time in church, was I would stay up late at night and watch Johnny Carson. And this tiny little man named Truman Capote would come out and sit down and cross his legs and had a little bit of a lisp, and he kind of sounded, you know, like me. He opened his mouth and 50 yards of purple chiffon came flying out. And I had never seen that. And it hit me in such a way that I'd have to go in the bathroom and vomit. It was so shameful to me, but yet intrigued me. And I somehow knew, and I'm not making this up, that my life would be intertwined in some way. I was cast this week in a play called Warhol Capote. It's being directed by Michael Mayer, who just won every Tony known to man.
From Spring Awakening,
We're opening at the ART in Boston for the out-of-town triadigo. I come to New York August the 7th to begin rehearsals. They're in discussions to play Warhol. It's based upon when Andy Warhol died, they found 59 cassettes of him and Truman. He was obsessed with Truman long before, you know, when he was Andy Warhola, living out in wherever, Pittsburgh. Long before he came to New York, he wrote him every single day. And he would stand outside Warhol's apartment, Truman's apartment, when he got to New York, till Truman's mother got drunk and went down there and told him, go away. Don't go. Leave us alone. And then they bumped into each other once again in Studio 54. But every time that they had a discussion, Andy taped it.
Wow.
And they've taken these tapes, and it's about, they yammer on and on and on about absolutely nothing and about everything. It's the most amazing piece of theater. And we're opening. So anyway, it's fun. This trip this week to the Metropolitan, I'll get to meet everybody. They're going to all be there. And Rob Roth is the one who wrote it, and Michael Mayer, and this one and that one. And of course, they have such deep pockets behind this show. I mean, like the, you know, the.
Oh, so they're really thinking.
They've got a few dollars.
Well, look, if they're looking for someone to play Andy Warhol, I could dye my hair, you know, and my beard.
It could be you and I.
Absolutely.
Right now they're talking to an actor named Reese.
Well, no, you're not allowed. You can't. If he's not cast yet, it's not fair to say whom they're talking to. So unless he's official, that's, you know, because if he doesn't get it, you know, that's sad for him. But let me ask, since you were going to Studio 54 and doing all that back then, did you ever run into Andy Warhol or Truman Capote?
Never. Never. I went to 54 one time.
Oh.
I came to New York. Listen, do you know that when I came to New York, I didn't come for anything other than I wanted to be a jockey. I went to Belmont Park, and I got a job exercising racehorses, and I lived in Elmont, and then I moved up to Garden City. I wasn't a city boy. I was out on exercising racehorses. So the whole time, I did go, but you know, that's kind of part of the whole drug thing too, was I had to stay so skinny. We were all of us.
But weren't you, you're 4'11". Isn't that a little too big to be a jockey?
No. It has nothing to do with height. It's weight.
Oh. So how?
It's weight.
How much did you weigh back then at your peak of slim fast slimness?
Well, you had to weigh about 108. I'm a very solid 133 now. I got sick. I ended up in the hospital. I got so sick from it, from the dieting and trying to stay so thin. And but yeah, it's weight. See, if you're handicapping a race, if you're a handicapper, your dream is to have every horse cross the finish line nose to nose. So to handicap a race, you assign a weight to each horse according to age, sex, and past performances. Now, to encourage trainers to ride jockeys who are new, let's say your horse is assigned 122 pounds. If you use a new jockey, you can deduct 10 pounds. So your horse can run at 112, which means they weigh the jockey. And if I weigh 108, 9, 10, 11, 12, then 4 pounds of weight go in the saddle, like the saddle cloths that horse is carrying. But, you know, if you can't make that light weight, then it's useless. And so most jockeys are my height, about 4'11", 5 foot, but they're tiny boned. You know, I'm a big bone. I'm a big gal. I'm a big old gal.
So how did you, remind us again, how do you go from doing, you know, working with the horses, being a stable person, living on Garden City in Elmont, Long Island, to that first bit where, oh, I'm really going to be a professional actor? How did that transition happen?
Here's what happened. I got really sick from trying to lose weight, and I ended up back home. I was hospitalized with just everything, exhaustion, infectious. I had like a serum B, which is a form of hepatitis, and I was really in bad shape, and from the drug use and everything. And so I got clean, and then I went back to school, and I was going to be a journalism major because I always could write stories. I wasn't even in plays in high school. I did a couple of plays in high school, but the very first day, people said to me, "You need to take intro to theater, and that'll get your art selective out of the way." And I walked into a theater class, and we did improvisations. Now, I've always been funny, but it was to keep the bullies at bay. You know, I learned how to be funny during dodgeball when they would say, "Smear the queer," and hit me with the ball.
Nice.
I was funny. And all of a sudden it hit me like a drug. And I went to the head of the theater department, and I said, "This is what I want to do." Well, in 2 years, because I'd already been to school and gotten a lot of stuff out of the way, in 2 to 3 years, I had a degree in theater. This would have been 1982. I got on a bus. I had $1,200 that my mother sewed into my underpants. Oh. I had been told by the theater department, "Mr. Jordan, if we're going to release you out into the world with your degree, you must learn to pronounce it. It's not theater. It's theater."
That's right.
I got me a degree in theater. And I took a bus to Hollywood, California. I'm not making that up. No. I had a suitcase and a dream.
And also the money in the underwear, which is both sexy and disgusting, if you think about it. But okay, yes.
Sewn into my underpants. And I went to work. I mean, I was very lucky. The year I got to Hollywood, Clara Peller, an actress out of Chicago.
Oh, my God, Where's the Beef lady?
Yes. She said, "Where's the beef?" And all of a sudden, Joe Settlemyer, who directed all those commercials, he ushered in this whole new era in commercials where they wanted characters. And I hit town. That's what I did for years, was I did a commercial. I was the Del Taco boy. "Morning, boys, how about breakfast?" I was the Pip printing guy. I did commercials. And that's how I got started.
Wow. That's so... And in that process, you started working on your one-person show and also starting to do TV as well.
Exactly. And so now, I won an Emmy for Will and Grace, which was 10 years ago, and I thought I'm going to kick back and let that everything come to me, and nothing happened. Nothing. I got down to 14 cents.
No, I don't understand this. I'm sorry, but you had an Emmy. You were known. People saw you on TV. They remember you. That you're. Maybe people don't know your name like a household name, but they know exactly who you are. And yet, you couldn't get cast. You couldn't get a pilot. You couldn't get anything off the ground. Why is it like that?
I think it had a little bit to do with it. Puts you in a weird. Once you win an award like that, it puts you in this weird kind of category where no longer does your agency want you to work for top of show. In other words, I'm the funny guy that comes in with a zinger. That's my job.
Right, yeah.
You know?
I've been there.
And they're not going to pay me to come in with a zinger, what I think my agency was asking. I don't know what happened. You know, it was just one of those flukes. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I didn't know, like the Kardashians do with this branding or anything. I called a marketing firm out in Palm Springs, and I said, "Listen, I'm broke. market me. My trip down the pink carpet, I said, you got to get me out there. And so I started really hitting the road, which I live now in hotels. I've lived most of the last 10 years in hotels. I do about 44 venues a year, and it's something that I absolutely love. And never once, because, see, I always thought, well, I can't do this because then the TV and film stuff, I'll be out on the road. And no, you work it out. And they'll work it out, you know. And so it's a wonderful place to be. And to be 62 years old, it's just like gravy.
Oh, my God.
You know, I'm out on the road. And then they'll say, well, you got to get back to L.A. because you're going to shoot this and la, la, la. And then they work it out. And I just, you know, it's gravy. And I'm in the best place I've ever been in, you know.
Well, we are, we are in a marvelous place right now with the wonderful Leslie Jordan. Remember, you can go see him this week, Tuesday and Wednesday night, at the Metropolitan Room on West 22nd Street in Manhattan. Also, to find out more about him and his other projects, and then he's going to be obviously in the Warhol Capote show, go to theleslyjordan.com, theleslyjordan.com. Do you have time for a couple more questions, though?
Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Yay. So here's one that the wife of the host of this radio program wanted to ask about Southern life and growing up and stuff. She says that the thing about Southern people is that if they want to insult you, they do it, but in a very sweet way where you don't even know that they're doing it, but there's a needle at the end of the calla lily. Is that sort of true?
Yeah, this is the way you do it. I can say anything I want about you if I preface it with, well, bless his heart. You know, he's just blah, 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 but bless his heart. You know, there's also a way in which that we, you know, what I love about the South, and this is not my quote, I borrowed this from my dear friend Linda Bloodworth Thomason, but in the South, we don't put crazy people away. We put them on the porch so everyone can enjoy them. There's just something about the way in which we embrace eccentric people that I've always loved, because that's where I've gotten my wealth of material, you know. It's just this aunt, you know, of mine, or this person I knew growing up. And but we do. We have a wonderful way, especially Southern women. Oh, my Lord, they can just be awful in the things they say about one another. But, well, you know, bless their heart.
Oh, Lord. Now, and I also have to ask, I've heard...
She's gotten so fat, she's as big as Dallas and half of Fort Worth. Bless
her heart. I've got to start using that as well. Now, also, one thing I read somewhere that you... I don't know if you turned this down or if you took it, but they offered you an MC job of a midget wrestling match in a gay bar. Did you take that...
I turned it down, but I've been offered all kinds of things. Yeah, no, I think I turned that one down. I rarely do. $100 a day in a square meal, and you've got me.
Oh, good to know. But why did you turn that down? Was it offensive to midgets or to bars or what?
It probably had to do with scheduling, because I do remember the offer coming in. Another time I was offered, they called me and they said, listen, we want him to do this filling station. And I thought, oh, what you mean stand out? You know, that's what in the South we call a gas station, a filling station.
Yes.
Well, it turned out it was Bill's filling station, which is one of the largest gay bars at one time in Fort Lauderdale. So I ended up doing it, but I said, I'm not going to do a filling station. I'm not. And they said, well, Leslie, you know.
It's not what
anyway,
you...
Anyway, I'd also been offered one time American Horror Story, the fourth season, which was Freak Show, and my manager called and said, let's see, we have a problem. You start on American Horror Story in 3 days, but you've been offered a reality show. And I said, well, I don't want to do a reality show. I'm an actor. He said, well, slow down. It's over in London.
Ooh.
And it won't, people here won't see it. I said, no, I'm not going to turn down American Horror Story. They said, Leslie, whatever it is, it's called Celebrity Big Brother UK, and they want to lock you in a house. I said, no, I do not want to do that. He said, the initial offer was $150,000. I said, well, forget Ryan Murphy. We're going to London. That was the biggest mistake of my life, though, but I did make that money. I had to give it to the IRS. But
Wait. Anyway. Why was it? You were on American Horror Story, so you have that credit. Why was it a mistake to go to London and do the Big Brother thingy?
Because they literally lock you in a house. It was a mistake in that I couldn't bear it.
For $150,000? You don't know what I would bear for $150,000.
Well, would you bear, what's his name, that played Buddy Holly, that other American?
Gary Busey.
Gary Busey. Doing number two on the on the toilet, not in. He would leave poop on the top of the toilet. It was disgusting.
Why would he do this? Why would Gary Busey do this?
Because he's really and truly not right. People think, you know, he, in my show, which you'll see, that's basically what my show's about at the Metropolitan Room, is that those 28 days I was locked up. You know, when he was in that motorcycle accident, his brains fell out. They put him back in backwards, I think, because it's his hygiene. You know, it's when someone's not right. He had toenails like Howard Hughes.
Okay, you know what? Even so, for $150,000, you could lock me in a closet with Yasser Arafat. I'd manage. Swear to God.
Well.
Now, let me also ask a more serious question of Leslie Jordan here, because we were talking before about the addiction and the alcohol, and also apparently at one point you were a sex addict, and then you were talking, uh-huh, though, about the AIDS era. Weren't you ever terrified from 1981 through 1995 of...
Lived in terror.
Yeah.
Lived in terror. It was every time I had a cold... Every time I got, you know, a cough, I'd go get tested. I got tested so many times that I would walk into the testing place, and because you could go for other things. It was urgent care, you know. You could go in there for this or that, but I'd walk in the door and they'd roll their eyes and say, "What now, Mr. Jordan?"
Well, but then again, it was the time. So, but were you at least always careful, or did you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. You know, once we knew, see, I think the sad part is that we lost so many that didn't know. Mm. You know, we didn't know. You know, the party was on. It was, you know, it was the sexual revolution. And here we were just having a wonderful, wonderful time. And we didn't know, you know, so many people didn't know. And I think, you know, honey, I was right there with them acting out. And so I think that's why those of us that are, you know, still around, we have such a, we have to keep on waving the flag, and I'm very, very active, you know, in all kinds of AIDS organizations. Always have been, you know.
But
I had to turn down. I was so sad. I go home to Chattanooga for Chattanooga Cares, which is, you can imagine what it would be like dying in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a long, long time ago. But anyway, because of this Orhal Capote thing, I had called in this week and tell him I couldn't come. But anyway.
But here's another question then. Now, AIDS and HIV are no longer remotely an instant death sentence, and there's all sorts of protection. There's also some ways to deal with it, and yet apparently you've been single for a few years now, and you're not even doing anything. Isn't that kind of, you know, bass-ackwards?
Well, you know, I've always been single. I've never had a boyfriend, really.
Oh.
I haven't. I've had, you know, during the day, I mean, my God, I lived with a straight man for 10 years I was in love with. Where's that going to get me? But I think part of the problem with growing up gay in the Deep South is that nobody taught a gay man how to love in a healthy and blessed way, you know. I'm still on that journey, learning how do you love in a healthy way. You know, I know how to obsess. My God, I know how to sit there like I did in school and, you know, unrequited love, you know, that quarterback and ooh and on and carrying on. And I was, you know, I'd get them to go have lunch with me, and they didn't know they were on it. I was on a date. You know, these old strange boys just going to have a hamburger, and I decided what outfit I was going to wear and everything. So, you know, the part about being single, I guess I'm married to my career. I don't know. I don't get lonesome ever.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I never miss you.
Well, do you have a wide group of friends and acquaintances that you go out to dinner with, you hang with, actor friends, etc.?
I do, but you know what happened when I turned? It was about 3 years ago, so I guess when I turned 59 or 60, I made a decision that is, I decided that at 6 o'clock at night, the curtain goes down. I don't go out. My friends go, well, of course you'll come to dinner. I go, no, I won't. I don't want to. They go, Leslie. I said, I'll have lunch with you. 6 o'clock, curtain goes down, unless there's a paycheck. If there's a big paycheck involved, then I go out. And it's changed my life in radical ways. I just love it. I don't, you know, it gets you out of so much. People say, well, if you ever got a nomination, you'd go, no, I wouldn't, unless there's a paycheck involved. Unless, you know, I just don't.
Okay.
I have a wonderful life. I don't know what I do. I don't watch television. I don't go to the movies. Last movie I saw was Brokeback Mountain. That was a really good movie. I didn't need to see anymore.
Wait, you don't even watch movies on Netflix or DVD or anything like that?
Nothing.
You must read a ton of books. Do you read a lot?
Constantly.
What's the last book you've read?
Well, right now I'm reading every Truman Capote book again.
Of course. That makes sense, yes.
So right now I couldn't believe I'm reading Other Voices, Other Rooms. But I went to my personal library at home and I thought, well, now I've got to look up and see what I have for Truman Capote. I had boxes. Boxes! I don't have to go. I thought, well, I'll have to do some research. I'm reading the George Plimpton. You know, we lost Gene Stein recently. He did the Edie biography, started that whole thing. This is, George Plimpton did a thing on Truman Capote where, you know, it's others talking about him, which has been very helpful with my research for this part.
So, let me remind people that if you want to see Leslie Jordan before he becomes uber famous again from doing the Warhol Capote play, you've got to go see him this Tuesday and Wednesday night at the Metropolitan Room in Manhattan. It's in Chelsea's on West 22nd Street. For more information, go to theLeslieJordan.com. And remember, it's Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, theLeslieJordan.com.
Or even better, let me tell you where all the information really is.
Oh.
You go on Facebook, I have the official page. You have to type it all out, the official page of Leslie Jordan. And that really has more than even my website. We keep that up.
So
better than my website.
So the last question for you is, besides the Warhol thing which just came through, what else should we be looking forward to from you in the next year to year and a half?
Well, I'm sort of waiting to hear about Will and Grace. I haven't heard about that yet. That's back, and I hope to be on that. But, you know, they're just now putting together storylines and stuff. I have a movie with Whoopi Goldberg that's a sequel to Sordid Lives, which is called A Very Sordid Wedding. It's coming out. I'm not sure where. Oh, so much, so much, so much.
Oh, my God.
And meanwhile, I'm in every city, you know, in every city near you, come known to man. I'm booked solid for 2017. So.
Oh, wonderful. Leslie Jordan, it has been absolutely wonderful and delightful talking to you. I only wish you more success, and I hope that you find that way to love people that you are looking for, too. Doesn't have to mean you have to get married or anything like that, but I hope you have that spiritual connection with people that you've been kind of seeking, you know?
Okay, thank you so much for talking to me, and I look forward to seeing everybody at the Metropolitan Room Tuesday and Wednesday night.
You betcha. Thank you, Leslie Jordan, and shalom.
Bye-bye. Shalom!
Bye-bye. Leslie Jordan with us in the neighborhood. Hello. So good to talk to him. Such a delightful person. So much fun. I'm Rabbi Sol Solomon. You've been listening to the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air.